My name is Erin Starr White. I am an assistant curator of education here at the Modern. I want to thank you all for attending the second lecture of this year's Modern Graduate Series. As you know, the series is designed to foster creative dialogue among the fine arts and art history graduate students from across the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. By hosting artists, scholars, and critics with the Texas Connection, we aim to expose area graduate students to a wealth of local and regional talent and knowledge. We hope that your participation in these evenings will serve as a catalyst for your intellectual and professional growth. For this evening's lecture, Emily Morrison, founder and director of Trouser House, a nonprofit art and urban farming initiative in New Orleans, will present a discussion on the past 2 years of Trouser House's existence and what lies ahead for the organization. This twofold project promotes a model of sustainability defined by community involvement and public education. As a catalyst for social change, Trouser House advocates contemporary art and food activism as vehicles for improving public health and personal well-being. Emily strives to provide art access to the citizens of New Orleans by hosting exhibitions, workshops, artist talks, and community gatherings to inspire residents to utilize art and farming in their everyday lives. Before opening Trouser House, Emily worked as assistant curator at ArtPace San Antonio. At Trouser House, Morrison has organized several exhibitions, including Business Casual, David Vega, Zine Library, which traveled to Unit B Gallery in San Antonio, and Exoskeletons. Her writing has been featured in numerous publications, including Art Lies, which is where I was introduced to Trouser House and Emily, the San Antonio Current, the Voices of Art magazine, among others. She holds a bachelor's degree in art history from the University of Texas at Austin. Please join me in welcoming Emily Morrison.
Can you all hear me if I'm not standing behind the podium, which makes me look even shorter than I am already? Okay.
Aren't you a podcasting?
Oh, do I need to stand in a certain location?
Yes.
Okay, it's fine. I'll be short like I am. Did my computer? Oh, it just went to sleep. Okay. I can look out of here. Okay. So it's been a minute since I've been in Texas. So it was nice to see all the cedar trees on the way in from the airport. I miss the Texas landscape. Being in New Orleans is a little bit different. So I started Trouser House in November 2009, and that project came about because I first visited New Orleans right after Hurricane Katrina. I've never experienced the city before the storm. And for those of you who have been there, New Orleans is a magical place for a variety of reasons. And when I went to visit in 2005, a lot of the homes and businesses were still abandoned after the storm. But I was there for Halloween, which is one of the super fun celebrations in New Orleans. And I was walking towards City Park along Esplanade Avenue one morning, and the light was coming through the oak trees. And I took a step and almost face planted because the sidewalk was completely falling apart. And when I stood up, I had this kind of like aha moment where I knew that for some reason, somehow, some way, I was going to live in New Orleans one day, and I didn't really know why. And that was kind of the beginning of my very strange relationship with the city of New Orleans. At that time, I was working at a place called ArtPace, which is an artist residency program in San Antonio, Texas. And ArtPace invites three artists 3 times per year to come and live and work in the space. It's a self-proclaimed artist-centric program. The residencies run for 2 months, and while the artists are in residence, They utilize a studio space to create work, which ends up being a site-specific exhibition that's on view for another 2 months. And I was there for about 3 years working in the curatorial department and really enjoyed meeting artists from all over the world and becoming fundamental to many artists and their practice while they were in residence in New Orleans. It was a cool way to get hands-on experience doing everything from helping with sculptural installation to works on paper to community involvement. But the reason that I really enjoyed working at Art Pace was not because I got to work with people like Hans Ulrich Obrist and Terrence Simon and these kind of more famous names that you hear about, but because I was involved with the education department there in a huge way. We saw over 20,000 students a year, and I really think that the education department at Art Pace has changed not only that organization, but also the community of San Antonio as a whole. And Art Pace, after 15 years of being in the city, I think is the reason that San Antonio is one of the highest funded cities in all of the United States for individual artists. There are more individual artist grants in San Antonio than you'll find in any other major city in the United States. It's something that not a lot of people know about. But if you guys travel there, you'll notice that there's something pretty incredible about the arts in the artist community in San Antonio. And I think the reason for that is because of Art Pace. So after working there for about 3 years, and as soon as the economy tanked, I thought it would be a good idea to quit my job. And so I resigned because I wanted to do something that was less artist-centric. It was less focused on developing individual artist practice and more focused on community development. I had recently learned about Harold Fletcher's Artist Social Practice Program up at Portland State University and worked with a variety of artists who were more involved in the social environment in their countries or their in their communities, and seeing how their individual works really affected the people that lived in the areas they were from. So I left, and I decided to live out of my car for about 5 months. And I traveled all around the country and talked to people, sometimes using my previous experience at Art Pace as a way to fool people in museums into giving me meetings, and ask people why contemporary art was important to them and why it was important to their community. And then kind of took it a step further, because I think I was crazy and drinking too much coffee at the time, and would strike up conversation with people in bars and coffee shops and ask them, why is contemporary art important to you? And I got answers ranging from, it's not, and leave me alone, to it completely affects everything that I do in my life, my mental health, my child's education, the economy in my city, the very design of my city in terms of transportation, in terms of the building, in terms of the way that the buildings, in terms of the way that I interact with my neighbors. So some people were really receptive. Most people were really receptive. And one community that really struck me was in Portland, Oregon. This is an image of a collective called Red 76, and they have a project called the Flying University, which basically instigates these kind of educational interactions in random places all over the United States. So they may host a workshop in a public square that's totally pop-up and completely guerrilla, I guess. And so Red 76 was an interesting concept for me, the concept of Red 76 and their Flying University, and really got me thinking about the institution, the museum-based institution, and then also the institution of education, and how much education affects and is affected by contemporary art. Yeah, and that's my coffee situation. Then at the end of that trip, I went to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and worked on a farm just outside of the city for their high harvest. It was a six acre biodynamic certified naturally grown operation. And while I was there, really had a chance to be still and remember what it's like to be in a rural environment again and process all the information that I had gathered from this 5 month whirlwind of conversation and coffee and driving my car. And so while I was there on Silver Wheel Farm, I realized that I wanted to return to New Orleans and stay. And not only did I want to go to New Orleans and work for a community-based organization or work in the arts, but I wanted to take what I had learned and start my own entity that would encompass as much of what I had gathered as I could fit into one space. So I moved to New Orleans and I founded Trouser House. And Trouser House combines contemporary art and urban farming. We have a variety of different programs that have developed over the past couple of years. And I would say the curatorial model mainly follows art that's working in, I guess, a non-commercial medium. Typically, we work with graffiti artists, folks that make zines, culinary artists, and all different kinds of people. So this is an image. These are some images of the space in 2009. We're located in the Bywater neighborhood of New Orleans, which is in the 9th Ward, a few blocks away from the Industrial Canal, which is the levee, one of the big levees that failed during Katrina. This is an area of New Orleans that is considered the emerging art scene, the epicenter for the emerging art scene, and has seen a lot of change since Katrina, since Prospect 1, Dan Cameron's project, and then in the past couple of years since I've been there with Trouser House. I've watched huge, huge amount of change happened since then. So the space is in a traditional shotgun, which is a typical architecture you'll find all over New Orleans. So the gallery's really in a house. It's very not white cube. The kitchen. And then in the back, this is the first day on the farm, which you can see. I still get really weird looks from people in New Orleans when I tell them that I have an urban farm, because then they ask me, how do you have a farm in the 9th Ward? And basically, the way that we just developed the farm was we invited people, as soon as we got into the space, to come and live and work in the space, or come and work in the space on a volunteer basis as much as they wanted, so that the organization could be built by a community of people. And in terms of the local community, initial reception was kind of low. I didn't know anyone in New Orleans, so starting a community-based organization in a place where you don't know the community is kind of strange. And so it took a minute to develop those relationships, and the way that we worked with lots of different folks was really through the WOOF program. This is an image. There we go. And WOOF is Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. We worked with a variety of folks from all over the world who came and lived and worked in the space in exchange for room and board. And the idea was that they would come to Trouser House and we would learn together how to build a farm in an urban environment, in a place where the soil is so toxic that you can't grow in it because you'll be ill from eating the vegetables and the fruits. And in a place where you can see in these previous images, this podium is actually full of just a small amount of the trash that we pulled out of the yard when we were clearing it out. So the first series of exhibitions kind of combined the detritus from the farm with work by a pretty well-known contemporary artist that we could get in the second room of the gallery. So the farm and the woofers were in development for about 6 months. We hand-graded the yard. We got all of our materials were either found or salvaged from recycle-based businesses in New Orleans. And we put in everything by hand. I didn't know what I was doing at all. And most of us who worked on this project didn't know what we were doing either. It was very much go by the seat of your pants and just kind of test it out. Trouser House is a spot for experimentation. It's a place to get up and try again and fall on your face and then try again. April. In April of 2010, we built our chicken coop, and the arrival of the babies also sparked the beginning of our education program and also our shift from monthly exhibitions, which were really geared toward emphasizing a marriage between art and farming and emphasizing the development of the space, to a seasonal schedule that fell in line more with what I was interested in and what other people that I was working with were interested in terms of art as social practice and non-conventional methods of art making. So when the chickens came, that's when we started working with a couple of charter schools down the street from New Orleans, down the street from Trouser House. And we saw about 200 kindergarten and third grade students. And what we would do is go into the school and give a presentation to the kids for about an hour. And the presentation would answer the questions, what is contemporary art and what is urban farming? And then we would do a creative project based on that lesson. Then a couple of days later, the kids would walk down to Trouser House. They would see the exhibit on view and go out into the farm, see the farm, and then do a creative project while they were at the space. So the first exhibit that the kids interacted with was one by a local artist named Stephen Kwok. And this installation was created for the gallery exhibit that he did at Trouser House. It's called To Do List New Orleans. And he sent out 16 different folks with a pad full of ledger paper to different posts in New Orleans. And they would walk up to random people and ask them to write down their to-do list for the day. And then we took those to-do lists and we posted them on the wall in geographic order in the gallery. So you could stand and kind of have this New Orleans experience, 24 hours New Orleans experience through the eyes of various folks from various different neighborhoods. So when we went to the schools and talked to kids about what their to-do list would be, they made their own to-do list for the summer. And their lists range from everything to learn how to fly to how to play basketball. And the kids really responded. They understood the act of making plans and being creative about what the possibilities could be and how that factored into their lives. It was really great. And that's the kids at Trouser House and then working in the farm on their project a couple of days later. And that's them meeting the baby chickens. After we did those programs with Young Audience, or excuse me, those programs with Arise Academy and the charter schools, I realized that it was quite a bit of liability to have 100 kindergartners in your house and in a farm. And we realized that maybe Trouser House was not the best platform for a field trip based education programs. So I formed a partnership with a local organization in New Orleans called Young Audiences, which actually started in New York City but has offices all over the United States. And what they do is they put artists in schools as educators for after-school programs. And I worked with them to develop curriculum for permaculture-based programming. And we installed urban gardens in 13 schools across New Orleans. And I now work with them in Marrero, which is on the other side of the Mississippi River, teaching middle school students how to become designers. Permaculture, in the sense of Miss Emily's class, is a system of design that's informed by patterns found in nature, modern science, and ancient civilizations. So my kids learn everything from how to grow their own food to how to tend their garden to how to harvest their garden, and then finally how to cook the foods that they produce. We also do solar oven design, rainwater catchment, all different kinds of nature-based design projects. But my favorite part of permaculture and working with these kids in Marrero is actually the first week of classes where we talk about ethics. And I introduce ethics to them from a design-based perspective. We talk about various land artists. We even talk about some graffiti artists who pay attention to care of the earth, care of community, and how we're responsible to one another. And it's really amazing to watch these kids realize that their community isn't just them and their family and their friends, but it's also the dogs and cats that live at their house, and it's also the food that they eat and that the land that they inhabit. So that's how Trouser House works with the kids in Marrero. That's them making worm composting boxes. So in tandem with education programs at Trouser House, we also do a variety of exhibits. I'm going to tell you about three of those. The first is called Zine Library, and this opened in November of last year. And the exhibit featured 50 artists from New Orleans, Texas, and Mexico City. And the reason that I loved working on this exhibit so much was because the type of folks that make zines in New Orleans are not the type of folks that like to rub shoulders with the typical Bywater art community in New Orleans. So the opening was kind of a clash of hipsters and punks. And I loved that because I loved watching them interact with one another, and I loved seeing the gallery full of folks that didn't normally come down to St. Claude Avenue and stay for a while. Because you can't walk into a library and then just walk out, glance at the books on the shelf, and then just walk out. It really requires that you stay a while and have a minute with the work. And then the second exhibit, well, another exhibit that we did this past spring is called The Glass Menagerie. And this happened on the 100th anniversary of Tennessee Williams' birthday, and then also the 25th anniversary of the Tennessee Williams Festival in New Orleans. Tennessee Williams was largely influenced by his time spent in New Orleans and is a huge literary figure in the city, but not someone that's really discussed very much in the circles of contemporary art. And so we thought we would curate an exhibit that focused on Tennessee Williams and his practice, but also the development of the glass art-based community in New Orleans, because before Katrina, New Orleans was one of the largest communities of glass artists in the South. After the storm, a lot of people lost almost all of their equipment, and so they didn't come back, or they came back very, very slowly. And so it had been several years since a collective glass artist, glass-based art show was put on in New Orleans. And this piece is called Sleep Soundly. It's by an artist named Josh Cohen. And it actually incorporates quartz crystal bowls, which are used in the semiconductor industry. And when you strike these bowls, depending on what size they are and how they've been constructed, they each have a different tone. So a lot of New Age folks use them for healing. And the semiconductor industry actually uses them to grow crystals. These bowls are the rejects, the ones that are not perfect for crystalline development. And so Josh knows this woman who has a giant warehouse full of them and made this sound-based piece out of these quartz crystal bowls. So when you walk into the gallery, this part of the gallery for this exhibit, it sounded like Tibetan monks kind of playing their tunes over and over and over again. It was really a drone piece. It was interesting to watch people walk through the first two rooms of the gallery, which had kind of conventional wall-based pieces and sculpture, and then get to the third room and kind of stop for a second, like, where am I? What am I doing? And then this is an image of the farm during one of the openings for the Glass Menagerie show. The Glass Menagerie was also the first time that we really started amping up our public programming efforts. So we brought in two local authors to do readings at the space during the Tennessee Williams Festival. And we also brought in a local theater company called Goat in the Road Productions, who did this piece called Our Man, which is staged in a 5x5x5 glass cube, which we installed on a floating stage that was above the raised beds in the farm. And it was really fun to see the theater crowd come down to the Bywater and be in art spaces. Fringe Fest happens in our neighborhood. The theater-based Fringe Fest happens in our neighborhood every fall. But aside from that, you don't see too much theater in art spaces. So that was a lot of fun. One of our most recent exhibits was called Eat Me, Drink Me. And this exhibit was inspired by Alice in Wonderland and my friend Joanne Amlin, who freaked out because she got a new pot that she could properly cook pork in. And when I saw her cooking in her kitchen that day and saw the like crazy fire in her eyes when she got that pot, it reminded me of a lot of artists that I had seen in their studios when they picked up their favorite brush or pen or were showing me their favorite work. And I realized that New Orleans is such a culinary community, and why isn't there any overlap between art galleries and culinary artists in New Orleans? So why not create something where people could interact with the two at the same time? So we installed a maze in the gallery, which we had a really hard time photographing, which is why this is what you're seeing, really the skeleton of it. But it was basically fabric maze that had 8-foot walls, and this was the kind of structure for it. And you travel through this maze, and as you travel through the maze, you happen upon these floating plates that had bite-sized sculptures for the taking. And these sculptures were made by two culinary artists in town, Joanne, who's like obsessed with meat, and Dawn, who's a vegan pastry chef. So the first room was the truffled eggs and gorgonzola prosciutto and sage, and the second room was wild blueberry tarts and honeydew mousse parfaits with mint leaves. And for that show, we did two performances for that show over the summer. And if any of you guys have ever been to New Orleans in the summer, it's pretty hot. So most people leave during the summertime. And this is Joanne in the kitchen. We kind of did it in the summer hoping that not a lot of people would be around in kind of this mean way, I guess. But ended up seeing about 500 visitors this summer through that exhibit. We had lines down the block for 2 hours. I guess that's what happens when you offer free food in a gallery. But one of the fundamental elements of the Eat Me, Drink Me show was audience participation in the form of comment cards. So everyone that came to the door was given a piece of paper, a piece of ledger paper, and a pen or a pencil. And we asked them to provide us with feedback on their way through the maze. And as they went through, people could write down what they thought about each piece or the whole experience. Then they emerged into the farm, and we had a mixologist in the farm making herb-infused drinks using produce from Trouser House Farm. And the comment cards, we have like a stack of 500 of them, and they're amazing. Everything from "this is the best art that I've ever tasted" to "this isn't art at all." And I love that comment, "this isn't art," because what is art? It's a lot of fun to test the boundaries. So let's see, where am I at? Oh, okay. Okay, so that's kind of 2 years of Trouser House in a nutshell, in condensed form. And now I want to talk a little bit about art as social practice in New Orleans and the idea of starting a community organization in a community that you don't necessarily know, and the unique experience and the unique city that New Orleans is. So I'm sure you guys are aware there was a storm there a while ago. And after Katrina, the population pretty much flipped. And a lot of artists and young people moved to the city because it became a template for experimentation. It became a place where almost anything was possible. And with Dan Cameron's Prospect Project, the international contemporary art world had a bit of an eye on the city and what was going to happen there. The Bywater neighborhood and the Ninth Ward neighborhood where I live is a strange place because most of the folks that live there are renters. Most of the folks that live there haven't lived there for very long. There's a lot of turnover still. Trouser House is on St. Claude Avenue, which is kind of the barrier between a white, high-income, educated area of the Ninth Ward and a low-income African-American neighborhood behind us. In both of those neighborhoods, you see a lot of renters, and you see people who've lived there for anywhere from, on average, 6 months to a year. So there's a high turnover, and the community is difficult to understand because it's always changing, and it's kind of part of the beauty of being in the Bywater is that we don't know what we are, but at the same time, it's very frustrating and difficult in terms of developing community-based organizations and community-based movements when the community is so much in flux. So a lot of people, when I first moved to the Bywater, asked me about gentrification, and it's something that I think is particularly relevant for a lot of emerging artists and the way that we move into low-income areas because they are low-income areas and we can afford them, and because they're places that things can happen, right? I think about Detroit a lot as kind of New Orleans' sister city. It's an open canvas. And when I first came to New Orleans and the Bywater neighborhood, I was adamant that Trouser House was not participating in gentrification because how could we? We didn't have any money, and we didn't own our building. And then also because the space is really for the people that live there. It's a place that's supposed to improve access to education, improve access to information on how to grow your own food or live a more healthy lifestyle. And it's also a place where creativity is tantamount to everything that we do. It's so much fun to hang out with the kids in my neighborhood and listen to their crazy ideas about things that they could do or how we could improve the garden and see their kind of wheels turn. Now, 2 years later, rent has increased in that area by as much as $600 a month for some spaces, and a lot has changed. It's really hard to tell what gentrification means in New Orleans and what it means in the Bywater because it's something that's happening just now and something that's still up in the air, but it is something that I think about a lot as a director of Trouser House. I'm not sure that I'm exactly giving you guys any real insight on it. It's just a question that I have that I'd like to pose to you guys. And then there are other arts organizations that have been started and have kind of fizzled and gone away. This is an image from a space over on Music Street, which is a few blocks from Trouser House, called the Safe House. It was the site for Mel Chin's project, a funded project which focused on lead contamination in the soil, and was hosted by an organization called the Life is Art Foundation, KK Projects. And the woman that runs that organization was there in that spot for about 3 years, and then left to start a medical marijuana farm in California, which was supposedly going to fund the KK projects in New Orleans, and then about 6 months later abandoned the marijuana operation because she met a professional gambler and moved to Tasmania. Now, totally normal. This is a picture of the safe house that I took last week. 2 weeks ago, half of this block burned down. The person that lives next to the safe house spent tens of thousands of dollars renovating her house and building up that neighborhood. And she says that the reason that the house down the street burned down was because of drug wars. The city says it's because of an electrical fire. I don't know which is true, but either way, this area had the potential and still does have the potential to be something amazing, but needed an engine behind it that could sustain itself and could be something steady for the city. New Orleans doesn't even have any bedrock. We live on silt, so we're not exactly the most stable foundation. And it definitely affects us. I think the Mississippi River is constantly working on us in New Orleans. Cultural economy is another thing that I think about a lot as a director, and in conjunction with a prospect project, because that was one of the main things behind Dan Cameron coming to New Orleans, was to bring an arts-based economy to the city. New Orleans has always had tons and tons of art in many different forms. Visual art hasn't necessarily been a centerpiece of the city. But Dan Cameron was really hoping to bring that. Whether or not that's going to come to fruition is also something I'm not quite sure of yet. But it definitely has sparked a lot of development. I go to a lot of neighborhood association meetings and transportation meetings. And we recently got a contract for our neighborhood to have a streetcar run down to it, which is huge for us for tourism and bringing folks into the neighborhood. So this brings me to the next part of the conversation, which is that in the spring of this year, I had a graduate student in arts administration from the University of New Orleans write her thesis on Trouser House, and this was basically a 40-page document on what I was doing wrong in terms of working as an administrator, which I really needed because I'm not always 100% together. And she brought to my attention that although we were in good standing with the IRS and we also have our licensing with the state of Louisiana, we were not certified as a business with the city of New Orleans and that we needed to go and get an occupational license for our building. So this summer, I went to City Hall and started talking to them about getting an occupational license for Trouser House. 3 weeks later, I got a letter in the mail that our occupational license had been denied because our building was not up to code. Even though the building is zoned commercial, it's never been used as a commercial entity, so it has to be brought up to code for 2011. Trouser House was built in 1890, the building itself, and hasn't been renovated since then. I think after Katrina, we got like a new coat of paint, but that I think was the extent of the renovation. So as you can imagine, the space is not safe for large crowds and it's not handicap accessible. So I've been talking to the city and walking past all of these occupiers to discuss the situation with the mayor and his staff of people and what we can do at Trouser House. And on Halloween Day, found out that the city was willing to work with us to create zoning that would apply for the Trouser House model because that zoning doesn't even exist, but that in order for the city to do that, we would need to move to a different location. So that was last week. And there we go. Ironically, right now we're hosting the Salon de Refusé, which is an exhibit that is inspired by the original Salon de Refusé that happened in the late 1880s in Paris, France. And the exhibit was hosted by the government because that year the official salon rejected hundreds of artwork from their galleries. And the public responded saying, how can you reject so many artists? How can you say this is not art? What do you know? And Napoleon III was like, oh, you think we don't know what art is? Well, we're going to show you by hosting an exhibition of rejects in the galleries adjacent to the official salon. And so the Salon des Refusés opened, and at the time it was an extreme failure. Women left the galleries crying because of the content, and people thought it was just general crap. But it was the first time that the Impressionists collectively showed their work and really marked for many art historians the beginning of the avant-garde movement. So at Trouser House, we were hosting an exhibition of rejects, a Salon des Refusés, for artists who had not been invited to participate in Prospect 2, and also artists who were interested in the development of the avant-garde in New Orleans, particularly with the movement that's going on on St. Claude and in the Bywater. In conjunction with the Salon des Refusés showing, the city of New Orleans revoked our permit for operation. Well, we never had one, so I guess they didn't revoke it, but they denied it. And so now we are in the process of going mobile. November 30th will be the last day that the gallery is open in its current location. And we're going to host a discussion group with graduate students in New Orleans on community arts and the development of Bohemian movement in New Orleans. So in closing, I just want to show you a few images of folks who inspire me every day and the work that I do at Trouser House. This is an image of a Houma Indian. This is Blue, who's an Italian graffiti artist whose mural was painted over recently. This is Regina Jose Galindo, who is from Guatemala City. And this is a performance piece that she did on the steps of their state government building in response to all of the missing and deceased people in Guatemala City. And this is Ai Weiwei. So thank you for having me. If you have any questions, I'd love to hear them. All right. Thanks.
Where did the name Trouser House come from?
When I first moved to New Orleans, I was reading Kate Chopin's The Awakening. And Chopin lived in New Orleans at the turn of the 19th century and published this book, which was about a woman who cheated on her husband and then committed suicide by walking into the sea. And when that book was published, it created huge stir with the literary community. And after that, she wasn't able to get anything else in print, and she was completely ostracized, not only by the public, but even by her own community. And I started thinking about folks who make waves, particularly women, and the saying, who wears the pants in your relationship? And I thought that at the space that I started, everyone would get to wear the pants every once in a while. So that's what I called the Trouser House.
I'm just curious, what was Trouser House's and your reaction to BP and the oil spill in the Gulf Coast?
When the oil spill happened, I had developed a relationship with an artist named Lisa Corradino, who lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And she's someone who's really influenced my practice as an educator in terms of my knowledge of permaculture and education. She lives in an artist community outside of Santa Fe that's completely off the grid. And so I invited her to do an installation in the farm at Trouser House. And you could see in that picture of the farm at night, there were a couple of light box pieces in the back. And those pieces are powered by solar panels on the shed in the farm. And one of those pieces is called Gut. And it's made out of a recycled signage from a defunct gas station off of Route 66 that she's reworked to spell out the word gut. And then she creates these caps out of photographs and puts the caps onto the light box that she has. She powers them with like LED lighting. And the gut image is of an oil slick from the BP disaster. So there was a lot. I was also working in food service at the time that that happened, and there was a lot of reaction across the community to oil in the water and seafood and people not traveling, and it really affected the city in many different ways. And it was interesting to see how people responded. From I'm going to get my check as quick as I can to BP, to folks out on the steps of City Hall protesting, to people just completely devastated and not talking about it at all. I don't know. Yeah. It really did affect the community in a huge way, but it's like we live in a place that is consistently being reminded that we can't control nature. We can't control nature. I mean, the Industrial Canal was initially built so that ships wouldn't have to travel up the Mississippi. It was like a one-way thoroughfare into New Orleans. And it was like the hugest engineering failure of the city because they could never keep it dredged enough for people to go to want to travel up and down the canal. And then the levee failed, and that's what flooded the entire Lower Nine. So it's interesting to think about the way that we change the city and the environment to fit our needs and then react when it explodes in our faces.
Yeah, I'm interested in, was there any sort of funding available to you for your project? I know the city sort of didn't support it, as you're telling, but was the house completely sustained by the activities you created?
That's a good question. It's kind of a fundamental question for a director of an organization to tackle, is what is sustainability, what is financial sustainability for the arts today? Public funding for the arts is disappearing. In the state of Louisiana, the first year that I was there, funding for the arts was cut by 80%. The Glass Menagerie exhibit, ironically, was funded by the city of New Orleans. The Arts Council provided us with money for that exhibit. We got a grant for the garden from Pfister's, the sort of company. I worked also with AmeriCorps for the first few months that I was there. I had a woman who was interested in learning about arts administration and grant writing. And so we worked together to implement a traditional nonprofit model, which was based on grant writing and fundraising. After about 8 months of that, I realized that not only am I a really bad fundraiser, but grants don't exist, and the ones that do exist go to organizations that have a long-standing history, which I can't. I don't contest. I wouldn't want the New Orleans Museum of Art or the Contemporary Arts Center to not have funding, so that I could have funding. I don't know, maybe I should want that. But anyway, at any rate, so we kind of moved into a hybrid. And I went to a few farmers markets and tried selling sustainable systems, everything from rain barrels to custom chicken coops to education classes and farm birthday parties, which didn't exactly work too well. And then I realized, after working in food service for a little while, that why wasn't I tapping into the number one source of economy in New Orleans, which was tourism? So we started an art tourism program at Trouser House. We built a Murphy bed into the third room of the gallery, and people can actually rent Trouser House and live there for their vacations for a nightly rental rate. So you kind of have this like night at the museum style experience. Right now, if you sleep on the Murphy bed, You'll wake up to a 5-foot by 6-foot painting called Picture of Poise, which is a giant nude male body with a 3-foot ass with a horse head looking back at you. It's awesome. So people, the art tourism program has really become the model for sustainability for our organization. We also sell alcohol during opening night events, and that helps with paying the bands and the people that do kind of the performative aspect of things for opening nights. So that was another thing. It was kind of like we spent 2 years running through a lot of different models, like how can we make money doing this and still do it at the same time and not like be rolling in it, but just pay the rent, basically. And when we finally arrived at that with art tourism, and that's the issue that we're having with zoning. We can get zoning in another building, not at Trouser House, for conventional gallery assembly space, but the zoning doesn't exist for a non-owner occupied guest house or bed and breakfast. So that was one of the big issues, and that's why I went to City Hall so many times and went back on Halloween. I kind of knew on Halloween that we weren't going to be able to work in the building that we were in, but I wanted at least to get some kind of agreement from the city that if we could find the right spot, that they would either make a law or find a law that would allow us to have the type of business that we do have, because artist-run organizations and community-based organizations have to move to a hybrid model if they're going to stay alive, in my opinion, with the current situation in terms of public funding in the arts. So we're kind of almost social entrepreneurs and less a real nonprofit. That's a good question. Thanks for asking.
Am I correct that the house that was sort of dilapidated was the house that Mel Chen had used? Could you talk a little bit about your feelings about that status of the house that was originally bringing something to the community?
Yeah. Kirsha Cahill and the Life is Art Foundation was an organization that emerged in tandem with the Prospect Project. And really, Kirsha was featured in Art Forum, New York Times. It was the project in the city that got international press. It was what made the lens, it wasn't what made the lens turn on us, but it was where the lens was focused. Mm-hmm. And she had the whole block. And the stuff that she was doing in that space was insane. She had a dinner for the Andy Warhol Foundation in the middle of the street on that block, where she closed off the street and she put out white linen covered tables, and she had this gala event basically in the middle of the hood in New Orleans, and raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for this initiative that eventually was run into the ground, not just from an organizational standpoint, but also from a structural and community-based standpoint. Almost all the buildings that she was working on are completely gone. She didn't even own a lot of the buildings that she was working on. She left the city owing them $40,000 in back taxes. And it was really...
There's been no follow-up reporting on that?
There is reporting on it, but the follow-up reporting on that happens within the city. The art critic that works for the Times-Picayune has a thing for Kirsha, and that's all he writes about. And that sucks, because there's so much more going on that's alive, and that's really working hard to keep things going. And their focus in terms of local arts is on how contemporary art runs buildings into the ground and wears Prada. And that's not reflective of what I think is actually going on in the community. So my personal feelings, really, really disappointed. And working to not be viewed in that light.
Have artists like Mel Chin kind of weighed in on this since that was...
Yeah, I mean, they have. It's also something that people don't want to touch with a 10-foot pole. Like, you don't want to be associated with that. It's not a good thing to be associated with.
I heard of... I mean, it's interesting that this is all happening, I guess, like, because I had a conversation today with someone who talked about being in a class at Carnegie when he was in grad school there, and it was on art in the social realm, and the professor, you know, kind of the word of warning initially was you have to be really cautious about, you know, art parachuting into these places and then leaving the community wondering what to do with the parachute, you know. That's kind of all they get from it. And it is too bad because, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in a way, art, big A, deserves a spanking for that. And it should make the art you're trying to make happen and make a difference with really pissed off. I mean, I think it's just such shame because, you know, I was so moved by everything I saw, and then I saw that, and I was like, damn.
Well, that's New Orleans. That's what happens in New Orleans. I mean, it's a place of constant turnover, whether it's the people that actually live there turning themselves over or the natural environment turning itself over. And it's also a question of art is social practice and community involvement, like I was talking about earlier, when the community doesn't know what it is. Mm-hmm. And then there are some aspects of the community that do have a very developed sense of identity that are really hesitant to be open to new movement because of things like what happened on Music Street, and understandably so. But it also goes back to the fact that there are potholes in my neighborhood that eat my car on a regular basis. I live in a food desert. I have to drive 20 miles to get to a grocery store, even though I live in a city. The kids in my neighborhood have, before Katrina, the illiteracy rate for high school graduates was 30%. That's insane. Insane to me. And I work in the school systems a lot. I'm there every day, and it's really difficult to be in that environment. And then also there's violence. So it's like, where does art fit into that? How can contemporary artists and arts-based organizations improve or add to a situation like that, and then just survival for the individual. Like sometimes it's super renegade, like cowboy hooligan in New Orleans, you know, it's like you're like always selling something, or it's very whatever all the time. And I never really understood that because I lived in Asheville, North Carolina, Austin, Texas, and San Antonio, Texas. And I mean, the closest I ever got to living in a place like New Orleans was the south side of San Antonio, and it's nothing compared to the Ninth Ward in New Orleans. And I'm not like, I always hate artists that say that for like street cred, because it's not that. It's very real. And it's especially real when you invite your neighbors into your house and you interact with these kids on a regular basis. And they're so awesome. The kids are so awesome in my neighborhood. And they don't have access to very much. And it's like, how can I be an educator? How can I... And then I don't know what's right for them. I don't have history, you know, so it's confusing sometimes.
Well, question. You said that you're going to take Trouser House. It's going to become mobile.
Mm-hmm.
How do you plan on doing that?
Well, there are a few options. Since the letter went out that announcing that we would be closing, there's been a lot of response from various folks who come to Trouser House, who have leads on possible real estate. Before even thinking about real estate, there is an organization in the city called Parkway Partners who started a bunch of community gardens in the Bywater, and I can think of, off the top of my head, three spaces that are totally covered in weeds and haven't been used for the past 2 years that I've lived there. And every time I walk by those gardens, I'm like, I can just go weed for a few hours and it will be ready and we could grow there. And now I'm like, why don't I be the engine behind those projects and get those projects kick-started again? Because the Trouser House Garden is a place for people to gather. It wasn't necessarily a spot that could be a community garden because of space, because of liability, and just because of kind of actually really like a lack of interest. I think that may have been partially because I wasn't pushing it as much as I could have been pushing it. I think though with the Parkway Partners, because the history is already there and that land is available, that people will be excited and interested in working on those projects again. And so that's one of the ways that I'd like to go mobile. Another project that I had planned for spring of this year is an international kite exhibit. And I wanted to do a kite festival on the French Quarter landing of the Mississippi River because there's this like awesome perpetual wind that comes off of the water there. And I think that we can still get a special event permit and do a kite art fair on the river. So we can still do projects. We don't have to have a home base. Kind of putting together the Trouser House archive in a little bit more of a comprehensive fashion. The website's kind of wordy, like me. So I think maybe organizing it a little better would be helpful. Because I have a lot of resources that artists and farmers and educators and just, you know, those can use. Yeah.
What, with that in mind, do you live there or nearby the Trouser House? Is that what you're, are you located in that area?
Yeah, I live 3 blocks from the house right on the industrial canal.
So I was just wondering what kind of exit strategy you had so that the community kind of understood what happened. It doesn't just look like another vacate kind of situation. Do you have, you know, well, to close down the Trouser House and make that clear and all?
Right. Well, I sent a letter to the Trouser House mailing list, which is about 500 people, on Sunday night. The community knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's been a secret that we're trying to work with City Hall. What happened was the city of New Orleans got a new mayor who's interested in cultural economy and bringing everybody to by the books operation. Before Trouser House, New Orleans was run by Ray Nagin, who's like a hooligan and didn't care about anything for licensing, safety. He like stole a bunch of money from the city, kind of really bad administration. But so that's why a lot of spaces didn't have and still don't have occupational licensing. At the beginning of the summer, this place called Bacchanal got cited on Friday night in the middle of operations. It's like this wine bar that has music. And the city sent in what's called quality of life officers and shut down their operation in the middle of like a Friday night jazz event, saying that the music was too loud and they didn't have a permit for music. And that created like a huge stink in our neighborhood because Bacchanal is one of the bases for music in our neighborhood. And after that happened, the Office of Cultural Economy sent out an email to all the artist-run spaces in, on St. Claude and Bywater area saying, hello, we're so glad that this is a new emerging area and we're really looking forward to working with you and we're here to support you. And just so you know, you have to have a license and you have to file sales tax reports every month. So like 15 galleries rushed City Hall all at once within like a span of a week after getting that email. So it's on the radar of people in that area that that's going on and that there's been an overhaul.
As in the neighborhood? Like those kids know you're leaving or the Trouser House is
No, closed. the kids don't. No, no. The kids that I teach know. My neighbors know. Because I've told them. I mean, I live, one side of Trouser House is a funeral home, and the other side is this lady with her two kids and wiener dogs. And Arthur is, like, awesome. He drives an Escalade hearse, and he wears a pinky ring and a three-piece suit every day to work, and he, like, wheels the bodies. You can see the bodies going in and out from the Trouser House garden on a regular basis. It really freaks people out. I love it so much. But he's really sad to see us go.
So word will get out. It won't just look like, you know, Trouser House.
No, and even, I mean, I think our exit is not, we improved the property that we were on. We built a beautiful garden in the back. We made a place that is better physically. And then the concept and the education-based component of it will still live on.
Good.
It's not just, I'm not moving to Tasmania.
You're a gambler.
And we're not leaving a big hole in the building. And I do still have the lease for another year. So I'm right now subleasing it to a woman who is a produce buyer down at the co-op, which is a new grocery store that just opened. And she's interested in keeping the garden alive, keeping the space alive. So that was important for me, that someone would go into the space that wanted to keep it. Not keep it going as it was, but continue to make it a beautiful place and a safe place for people to be.
It sounds like you just determined to make this work. And I admire how you just kept working at it and kept figuring it out, even though you didn't have all the skills to start it and keep it running. And I was wondering, it seems like the missing piece with us artists is that we don't get involved with politics. We need to be on the other side of the ball, be on the city councils, and
yeah.
Be a part of the decision-making process on the political side of it. Have you thought about becoming a part of the community in that way, running for office, getting on the city council?
Running for office? No, not that much. I mean, I go to neighborhood association meetings.
Okay.
I go to the RTA meetings, the transportation meetings. I have a relationship with Kristen Palmer, who's our councilwoman. And when I went to City Hall on Halloween Day, the reason that they gave me a meeting was because I sent them a letter that was like, I want to invite you to the last event at Trouser House. And I want to tell you why this is the last event. And then I want to tell you what's happened at the space over the past 2 years. And thank you for funding us, by the way, for one of our exhibits. And then here are my suggestions for how you could improve your operations and the information that you make available to people in the city so that artists and cultural organizations can more effectively operate and function, have a better relationship with City Hall. And so when I went in to talk to them on Halloween, I went in not just to try and figure out what we could do for the space itself, but also to say, like, hey, I've been going through this for 3 months, and this is... here are my suggestions, like from an artist's perspective, from an organizing, community organizing perspective, this would make this process a lot easier. So I'm involved. It's the same thing with teaching. Like, I teach, but I'm not in the school. I'm not officially part of the school system, which frees me up from teaching to a test or teaching to a state curriculum. I'm involved with the city and I'm involved with city council, but I'm not married to the law books, which are absurd. So I can navigate and hopefully have input, and hopefully be heard, but not be married to it. I'm in a problem, I guess.
Okay, I think we're at time. There is a reception in the cafe until 7 if you guys want to move in there and you can ask Emily more questions. And thank you for coming.